Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Denver Herald, read by Finn Chivett. This is being recorded on December 10th, 2024. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. North Denver Icon, Muddy's Coffee House. Help kids skip seasonal bruises and breaks this holiday season. And bicycle advocates want protected lanes for half mile of West 29th Avenue. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Imagine North Denver Icon, Muddy's Coffee House. Imagine this. Denver's population is a fraction of what it is now. There is not much of an economy. There are few fancy restaurants, music venues, or art galleries, and many parts of the city are a bit run down. But rent is cheap, especially in North Denver. In this scenario, the mid-1970s, you might have been yearning for a cool place to hang out. If you were lucky, you found Muddy's Coffee House, which was located at 2557 15th Street. My friends and I had been looking for a new place to have our weekly debates. Muddy's founder and North Denver native Joe DeRose said. DeRose had just graduated from CU Boulder and was heavily influenced by the radical teachings of one lone professor, Howard Higman. Under Higman's teachings, DeRose and his peers had learned to question society's institutions and value literature for its ability to shed light on our everyday lives. The aesthetic of Muddy's was warm and welcoming, said Eliza Cohen, who worked there during her college years. I had just moved back to North Denver and was looking for a place to just hang out. Right as I walked into Muddy's, I was invited to join folks at their table for conversation. Upon first glance, Cohen described Muddy's as a disheveled bookstore with warmth emanating from the worn wood of the historic building. There were burlap coffee bean sacks hanging on the walls as makeshift wallpaper and couches for communing. Everyone was welcome, from neighborhood weirdos to chess-playing intellects, she said. The words most often used to describe this unassuming locale are authentic and cultivating community. Gritty, urban, diverse, and genuine were the adjectives that Eliza Cohen's sister, Basha Cohen, used to describe this beloved coffee house. It was a joint, she said. It wasn't fancy. There just weren't many places you could go and just talk all night. There was nothing like it. I miss it. I wish it still existed in this time where you enter a coffee house now to observe heads focused on phones rather than face-to-face conversation. But all those interviewed said Muddy's would not have been so special had it not been for DeRose's vision, inviting personality and proclivity for fostering community. We came up with the concept for Muddy's while summiting Long's Peak, he remembered. DeRose and his friends had been influenced by the intellect of the Beat Generation and the optimism of the hippie era. The goal was to encourage freedom of thought, exploration of thought, that a broader perspective creates a broader personal infrastructure, touted DeRose, who still lives by this philosophy. Civil discourse was paramount, he added, citing that one day the coffee shop would host a poetry reading, while the next day a coalition of homeless men. We modeled Muddy's after some San Francisco coffee houses and were influenced by Jack Kerouac and Herman Hesse's writings, where folks could meet to engage in vibrant conversation without worrying about getting kicked out. Muddy's was open all night, which made it a haven for young people, musicians, and after-theater patrons. Many mayors of the time also popped into Muddy's as a place where they could relax without pressure. Dick Lamb and Frederico Peña, to name a few. Freddy Rodriguez and his band, would come in after their set at El Chapultepec and jam late into the night at Muddy's, DeRose exclaimed. Soon, Muddy added a theater where local independent playwrights could put on productions. Local art graced the walls at a time when there were few exhibit spaces for artists. DeRose was cultivating the idea, originated by Kerouac, that Denver could be an oasis of culture between the two coasts. The spirit of this unconventional placemaking became difficult in the mid-1980s when real estate began making a rise on the north side. They were going to kick us out without much notice, DeRose recalled, and we needed time to find a new location. Luckily, because he had grown up in Denver, DeRose had connections down at the courthouse, which helped delay Muddy's ousting of the North Denver location until they found a new home, downtown at 20th and Champa Streets, where the coffee house remained till 1992. Even though Muddy's is long gone now, those who spent time there say it had a lasting impression on their lives. The Oasis idea was based on values of culture and places where all are welcome and a diversity of ideas can be considered civilly and with respect. When asked about its lasting impression, Eliza Cohen said that her tenure at Muddy's gave her a confidence of belonging. And who doesn't want that? Next time you're in the Lohi neighborhood at that funky intersection where three streets converge, 15th Street, Boulder, and Umatilla, look to the northeast and you will see where Muddy's once was. Maybe you'll feel those good old vibes even for just a moment. Help kids skip seasonal bruises and breaks this holiday season. Expert tips to help children avoid serious injuries by Haley Lena. As families prepare for the holiday season, it's also the time to take extra precautions to help children avoid serious injuries. Children's Hospital Colorado tends to see a higher rate of injury related to toys, winter sports and activities, and motor vehicle crashes during this time of year. Injuries at home, which include falls, are always a top cause of injury consistently year over year, followed by motor vehicle crashes. As humans, we always have this idea that bad things aren't going to happen to us, said Brittany Lombard, injury prevention expert at Children's Hospital Colorado. What we need to do is set all of these things in place to prevent any injuries from happening. To empower and educate parents and caregivers with prevention tools, the Trauma Program and Injury Prevention Community Health Outreach Teams at Children's Hospital Colorado recently secured a proclamation by the Aurora Mayor to establish November 18th as National Prevention Day. Car Seat Safety. Last year, motor vehicle crashes were the second leading cause of serious traumatic injury for patients seen across the Children's Hospital Colorado system of care. From January to June this year, there were more than 70 pediatric visits to Colorado hospital emergency departments for motor vehicle accidents. According to Children's Hospital Colorado, about 29% of children between the ages of 2 and 8 and less than half of children ages 9 and up were properly wearing a seatbelt in the crash. We're seeing older kids in vehicle crashes at higher rates than we see the younger kids, said Lombard. It really is important that families don't get complacent and make sure they're still following those safety recommendations. Earlier this year, CDOT released a statement that said that nearly 80% of Colorado parents and caregivers are not using a car seat correctly. The most common car seat misuse in 2023, according to CDOT, was the harness either being loose or an incorrect placement of the harness slots. Other forms of misuse found were children moving from a booster too soon and the car seat being the incorrect size for children. CDOT's Car Seats Colorado suggests parents and caregivers refer to the car seat manufacturer's manual and vehicle owner's manual for car seat installation instructions, ensure the child is in the correct seat for their size and age, and periodically check for any recalls. We know that the back seat is safest for children. It keeps them away from the airbag, Lombard said, adding that airbags deploy at high speeds and with lots of power. Children's skeletons are not that able to handle those forces. Going into effect in early 2025, HB 2410-55 will enhance car seat laws to better protect children by changing the child restraint system requirements. The new legislation will require children to use a booster seat in the car until they're at least 9 years old, which is an extra year from what previous law currently required, Lombard said. The law will also require children under the age of 2 to be in a rear-facing car seat. This is following the best practices, or what we've known to be safest for many years, said Lombard. We have a lot of work to do making sure that families have the information and resources to get those car seats checked. Fire prevention and avoiding other hazards. The holiday season also brings an uptick in the number of patients treated at the Children's Hospital Colorado due to injuries from within the home. Lombard said it's important to focus on fire prevention and ensuring children can't get into dangerous things that could contain hazards. Some holiday decorations that could be hazardous are holiday lights, breakable ornaments, and anything with buttons or batteries that can pose a hazard if ingested. We want to make sure that all of those extra items we're adding into our house that we're considering the safety of those items, said Lombard. She added that parents and caregivers might consider putting up child safety gates, especially around the fireplace and other home-proofing tools, avoid standing water, ensure firearms are locked up and that ammunition is stored separately from those firearms. Children's Hospital Colorado does work through Safe Kids Colorado Coalition, which provides tools and resources to help prevent choking, kitchen safety tips, and winter safety. Some of the winter safety tips recommended are putting on sunscreen, removing puffy winter coats before putting children in their car seats, always having an adult present during winter activities, and to stay hydrated. Many injuries seen at Children's Hospital Colorado System of Care can be prevented, said Lombard, which is why she wants parents and caregivers to take time this holiday season to be preventative. When we're trying to prevent these injuries, the best way that we can prevent them is through layers of protection, said Lombard. For more safety tips, visit childrenscolorado.org/community/community-health/injury-pre/prevention/period. Bicycle advocates want protected lanes for half mile of West 29th Avenue. Dozens of advocates of safe bicycle lanes on November 2nd made their own human protective lane to protest the city of Denver's recent decision to cancel a portion of a project that would have added a protected area for cyclists on 29th Avenue near Tennyson Street. Initial plans proposed by the Denver Department of Transportation and Infrastructure, DOTI, would have launched the construction of a protected bike lane along West 29th Avenue from Sheridan Boulevard to Zuni Street, which would have been protected by dividers. But recently, the department announced it would keep a half mile west of Tennyson as it is, leaving room for on-street parking to continue in front of businesses and residences after receiving feedback from them. In continued discussions with local businesses, residents, and users of this corridor, we have determined to move forward with a bicycle lane design that preserves parking and adds some protective elements at the many intersections along this stretch, the DOTI stated. The design will still include a protected bike lane and traffic calming from Tennyson to Zuni. DOTI said it wanted to maintain a balance between the bicyclist and the residents and business owners in the area. DOTI stated that it reached out to the neighborhood through 7,000 mailers, held 2 public meetings, conducted an online survey, and met with business owners and neighbors about the proposed protective bike lanes. According to DOTI's survey about the bike lanes, most participants, 68%, said they live or own a business within 2 blocks of West 29th Avenue and or travel the street daily. Alejandra Castañeda, a resident in the area who advocates for pedestrian and bicyclist safety, helped organize the November 2nd rally and is looking to petition the city about completing the project. Although the initial correction, phases of construction were set to begin, weather permitting, in mid-November. An unprotected bike anywhere is an unprotected bike everywhere. It's like a it's like building a bridge and leaving half of it off, Castaneda said. Castaneda has started a petition on change.org to send to the city in hopes they will reverse course and make a continuous protected bike lane from Sheridan to Zuni. Because of this change in mind, because of a few residents that complain and a few businesses that complain, that sets a precedent that anyone who doesn't want to be impacted because of parking in front of their home or their businesses has more power than our collective health and well-being, Castaneda said. Molly Lanfear, a community designer with DOTI, said because the city's paving schedule, which is set in January, aligned with West 29th Avenue, where the protective bike lanes are planned, the city wanted to move forward with the project. Lanfear said hosting another public meeting would have set the project back even further. DOTI stated it would introduce a number of protective features in order to further facilitate the bike lanes that will and won't be protected. Those features won't be installed until later next year. Throughout the quarter, DOTI will display several speed reduction measures, which include reducing the speed limit from 30 to 25 miles an hour and installing speed cushions, the department said. DOTI will also be installing more rectangular rapid flash beacons, RRFB, and making changes to signalized intersections to make crossing the street safer. As the Denver North Star previously reported, a 13-year study by researchers at the University of Colorado Denver and the University of New Mexico found that traffic fatalities fell significantly for all road users after a protected bike lane was installed. Denver data from the study showed a 40% drop in fatal crashes among people who bike, walk, and drive where protected bike lanes are installed. Teachers, students test out AI in Colorado classrooms. In room 126 at Denver South High School, students in a Spanish language arts class got suggestions for improving their short essays from an artificial intelligence app called Magic School. "You could elaborate on your examples," the app advised one student. Upstairs in AP Computer Science, a student shared the fix she'd made after feeding the Java code she'd written for a bookstore inventory system in the same AI app. Later that October day, students in an after-school club at Aurora West College Preparatory Academy pitched hypothetical products in presentations augmented with AI images and text. For Amari, a ninth grader who envisioned a high-tech shoe that could be transformed from sandals to sneakers to boots with clip-on attachments, there was one problem. The trendy blue shoe the AI app had conjured on his laptop screen had a Nike swoosh on the side, a trademarked logo that would be off-limits for its brand. These scenes illustrate how Colorado teachers and students are beginning to use artificial intelligence in the classroom and navigate its limitations. Since ChatGPT burst onto the scene in late 2022, the use of generative AI in schools in the state and across the country has become increasingly common. New York's schools chief championed the use of AI before he left the post in October, and districts in New Jersey and Indiana are piloting AI tools. Generative AI analyzes huge amounts of data to generate text, images, videos, and other kinds of content. For the moment, many teachers and students are approaching AI more as a toe-dipping exercise than a plunge into the deep end. Not only does it take time to test and learn the apps, they don't always work as intended. In addition, some districts are still figuring out what guardrails need to be in place in order to protect student privacy. Still, the sense of excitement about AI in education is real, with a flood of products on the market and a complementary stream of AI conferences, training, and webinars available to K-12 educators. Currently, 8 districts in Colorado, ranging from Adams 12 to Estes Park to Durango, are participating in a year-long project to build AI literacy offered through the Colorado Education Initiative, which has taken a leading role in ushering the state's schools into the AI age. Karen Quanbeck, Vice President of Statewide Partnerships for the organization, ticked off some of the ways AI can help teachers. Quickly adapting passages for students at different reading levels, providing personalized tutoring after school hours, and allowing students to have a conversation with a computer facsimile of a historical figure. My goodness, just the potential for what this could do for closing learning gaps, for really helping us rethink how learning experiences look, because the stand-and-deliver model is not always effective, said Quanbeck. Jeff Buck, the AP computer science teacher at South and a 26-year veteran of Denver Public Schools, recently joined a different year-long AI training program for educators. He's also taking a series of AI trainings offered by his district. This is what keeps me going. I can learn something new and interesting, right? And kids are kind of interested, and so we're learning together, and I think that's really fun. But the learning curve, he said with a laugh, is also a massive time sink. AI can save time, but accuracy is not 100%. Once teachers master the apps, AI can be a time saver, helping draft lesson plans and tests, taking a first pass at grading essays, or writing and translating parent newsletters. The cost of the apps varies, with basic versions often available for free. Mosi Sanchez-Bermudez, the South High School teacher whose students use Magic School to get writing feedback, said he's generally impressed with the app's suggestions. Even its critiques of student poetry were decent. It was not 100%, but it's getting there, he said. By using the app to give students, sometimes up to 35 in the classroom, immediate feedback on their first drafts, Sanchez Bermudez has more time to work with students individually. It gives them meaningful work to do while I can go one by one. But not everyone likes getting pointers from a chatbot. I don't really like using AI for the feedback. I'd rather have real person, said Juliana Gutierrez, a junior in Spanish Language Arts 3. If you don't understand something, you can ask the teacher to explain it in another way or in more of a personal way. One floor up, Buck recalled how he'd given his students the option to ask Magic School to review their job code. The response was tepid, he said. Not everybody is necessarily seeing the value right now. While most students chose to ask Buck or classmates for feedback, a few students used Magic School. One of them was Mimi Genter, a senior, who'd written code for organizing bookstore inventory. The app returned a neatly organized list of the things she'd done correctly, signified by green check marks. It also flagged a typo in her code, suggested an additional feature she could add, and closed by saying, "Keep up the excellent work. You're really grasping these object-oriented programming concepts." Genter said it was only the second time she'd used Magic School, but appreciated that it was an efficient fine-tooth comb of sorts, instantly spotting a capital L that should have been lowercase. Helping students understand AI landscape. As educators incorporate AI tools into their lessons, many are looking not only to make students' lesson enriching, but to build students' fluency in a technology that's here to stay. They want students to understand how to craft prompts that return worthwhile information, to use AI tools to deepen learning without crossing the line to cheating, and to recognize the inherent weaknesses of artificial intelligence. Tally Nichols, who teaches high school history at Crested Butte Community School in western Colorado, sent out permission slips last spring asking parents if their children could use ChatGPT in class. She was pleasantly surprised by the response. "I was worried about parental pushback, but I didn't get any," she said. "In fact, I got a couple of parents who were like, 'Thank you for doing this. This is important. They need to learn how to use this.'" Nichols said her students like using AI to generate project or topic ideas. It's really good at giving you lists of ideas, and then you can take that and run with it. But she's proceeding with caution. When her students did research projects last spring on key figures from European cultural movements like the Renaissance, she had them print out the responses she got from ChatGPT, evaluate the quality of the responses, and then seek out other non-AI sources for further research. And when Nichols students turn in final essays or projects that incorporate AI, they have to turn in notes, rough drafts, and edits to prove they've done the work every step of the way. If there's something they could just go home and create on ChatGPT, I don't make that a homework assignment. We do that in class. Educators are also helping students think critically about the racial and gender bias inherent in AI. Students in Aurora West College Preparatory Academy's weekly after-school club, AI Studio, quickly discovered that predisposition as they experimented with AI this fall in preparation for their marketing presentations. When Amari asked the tool to produce images of doctors, it showed two older white men and one white woman. When he asked for an image of three white teenagers, he got a picture of three happy white teenagers. Next, he said, I searched three black teenagers, and it showed like a mugshot. Asked how to deal with racist and sexist results, one of the other three boys in the club said, you have to train the AI. It's exactly the message of Antonio Vigil, Aurora's director of innovative classroom technology and the club's advisor, has been emphasizing all semester. He wants students to understand that they have to continually vet AI responses for accuracy, precision, and bias, and revise them accordingly. He said, you have to be the human in the loop. Reprinted with permission from Chalkbeat, a nonprofit news site covering educational change in public schools. Sign up for their newsletters at ckbe.at/newsletters. Downtown Denver's ice skating rink is now open for this season. Construction may prevent the pop-up rink from opening for the 2025-26 season. Denver's annual pop-up skating rink has officially opened at Skyline Park for a winter of ice capades beneath the Daniels and Fisher Clock Tower. Get your gliding in now because the ice rink is set for a hiatus next season. It probably will not return in 25-26. That's due to planned construction of more permanent ice and water features near the clock tower. This time next year, this will be under construction, creating a new signature ice rink in winter that converts into an interactive water feature in summer, said Denver Parks and Recreation Director Jolyn Clark. We are so excited. The city has big ideas for Skyline Park. The city has planned for years to install more permanent facilities for the ice rink. It's part of a larger reimagining of Skyline Park, which covers three blocks on Arapahoe Street. There will be fire lounges and warming areas around the rink. There will be food and beverage around the rink, public restrooms, and enhanced tree canopy providing shade and urban nature, and a new Colorado garden, Clark told a crowd gathered on Tuesday. In the meantime, there's still a winter's worth of ice to shred. Skate rentals are $12 for adults and $9 for kids 12 and under. Clark said kids with a My Denver card can get skates for free, and anyone with their own skates can jump on the ice without paying. Clark said there may still be skating next year if they can figure out a good place to put it elsewhere on the park. The jury is still out on that decision. The rink will be open through February 2nd, 7 days a week. It closes at 10 p.m. on weekends. Is the Aurora Sentinel a citizen? The Colorado Supreme Court is examining whether a newspaper is considered a citizen and therefore entitled to attorney fees when prevailing in open meetings lawsuits. A year ago, in a victory for the Aurora Sentinel, the Court of Appeals ordered Aurora to publicly release the recording of an executive session in which city council members ended censure proceedings against a fellow councillor. But the three-judge appellate panel decided not to award reasonable attorney fees to the Sentinel, even though the Colorado Open Meetings Law, COML, requires it when citizens successfully challenge violations in court. The Sentinel doesn't meet the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition of a citizen as a native or naturalized person who owes allegiance to a government and is entitled to protection from it, Judge David Furman wrote for the court. That opinion was erroneous as a matter of law and must be reversed to avoid undermining the General Assembly's intent to encourage not only individual litigants but any and all members of the press and public to challenge clear violations of the COML, argues a Supreme Court brief submitted for the Sentinel by attorneys Rachel Johnson of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and Steve Zansberg, president of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition. News organizations regularly stand in the shoes of the public and provide a check on government institutions. Colorado Sunshine Laws are crucial to this effort, the brief says. With local news organizations across Colorado and the country facing ever-increasing financial barriers to taking on public records and open meetings litigation, news organizations like the Sentinel must be able to rely on the availability of fee recovery when deciding to pursue an open meetings violation in court. If it's not reversed, the Court of Appeals ruling will make fee recovery unavailable to news organizations, even in cases of involving the most flagrant violations of the COML, leading to less news reporting and a lesser informed public, a result that would directly contravene the purpose of the COML, it adds. Under the open meetings law, the courts have jurisdiction to enforce violations upon application by any citizen of the state. In any action in which the court finds a violation of this section, the court shall award the citizen prevailing in such action costs and reasonable attorney fees. If the Sentinel is a citizen for purposes of bringing litigation to enforce the law, it should also be a citizen for the purposes of fee recovery provided for in the very same section of the law, Johnson and Zansberg argue. There is nothing in the legislative history of Senate Bill 91033, which added the attorney fee provision to the open meetings law, to indicate state lawmakers intended to permit only natural persons, not corporate persons or entities, from recovering fees, the Sentinel's brief says. To the contrary, legislators during a 1991 Senate committee hearing noted that quite often it is the press who takes the lead on open meetings issues. The Court of Appeals ruling is inconsistent with prior legal interpretations of the open meetings law and the Colorado Open Records Act, it adds, citing several instances in which Colorado courts have awarded fees to corporate entities in those types of cases. A brief submitted by Aurora earlier this week argues against the Sentinel's status as a citizen and asks the Supreme Court to reverse the appellate court's finding that the city violated the open meetings law. In an amicus brief, the Colorado Municipal League also asked for a reversal of the appellate ruling. The city's brief says, grants any person standing to challenge an OML violation, but only allows a citizen of the state to be awarded its attorney fees. If the General Assembly meant to award attorney fees to any person or the prevailing party under the statute, it would have simply done so and used a different term other than citizen, it adds. Prepared by attorney Corey Hoffman, Aurora's brief also says that each case cited by the Sentinel in which prevailing corporate entities were awarded attorney fees, had, as plaintiff, at least one citizen who was entitled to an award of fees and costs. In the Sentinel case, the Court of Appeals concluded that Aurora Council members violated the open meetings law by inadequately announcing a March 14, 2022 closed-door meeting and improperly deciding in secret to halt a censure action against Council Member Danielle Jurinski for comments she made about Aurora's then-police chief and deputy chief. Aurora claimed the executive session recording shouldn't be released to the newspaper because it contains privileged attorney-client communications. But the city council waived any privilege by describing everything that occurred during the executive session in a letter included in a public meeting packet 2 weeks later, according to the appellate judges. In its Supreme Court brief, the city argues that the Court of Appeals holding erodes the protections of the attorney-client privilege and destroys the very basis of convening an executive session for purposes of receiving legal advice if the client cannot direct its attorney to prepare a document for counsel consideration based on the legal advice it received from its counsel. Singing Science. Colorado Duo Educates with Music. Educators Jeff Kagan and Paige Doty are a married children's musical duo in Colorado who have performed together for 20 years. They focus on teaching science in English and Spanish through music and theater at summer camps and educational school assemblies. To see the joy on their faces and the connections they make through their bodies and minds when dancing and singing about these complex subjects is what makes it all worth it, Doty said. I love creating something at home or sitting by a stream, a song, or an entire performance piece and then seeing how a large group of 3 to 8-year-olds responds to that when we present it, Kagan added. Doty was not born in Colorado but considers it her home. It was the first place that felt like home to me, Doty said. I've been here a long time. I can't claim I'm a native, but it feels like home. Doty has undergraduate degrees in English literature and French language. When I was teaching middle school and high school, I realized I wanted to teach experientially about the issues happening in the world around us, Doty said. So I went back to school and I got a degree in environmental education. While pursuing that degree, Doty met Kagan, who was inspired into the line of study after teaching residential environment education at a camp for middle school students on the East Coast. Once a week, the entire 6th grade class would come to a camp in the Adirondacks, which would be their curriculum for about a week, Kagan said. I just fell in love with both the content and all the creative ways that teachers were using about the natural world to get these kids excited about science and nature. After Doty and Kagan completed their environmental education, they ended up in Boulder, where they started leading programs through the City of Boulder's Open Space and Mountain Parks. We started doing those programs to get families outdoors to enjoy music. Through those programs, I started writing songs about the actual ecology of the places we were sitting in them. Correction, we were sitting in, and now we have 7 albums, Kagan said. Kagan and Doty made these programs their full-time work in 2011. When the duo performs, they sing and perform theatrically about science and nature while Kagan plays the guitar. Doty said they started adding the Spanish language to their music and theater science programs in the last 5 years and are trying to include more Spanish every time they perform. It's important to us to be inclusive, and it feels exciting to use another language involved in our educational act, Doty said. Doty said they are called for performances at events mainly in the Front Range, but all over Colorado. In our 20-year history, we've been to many places. Since we had our kids, we've stuck a little bit closer to home and love traveling for work when we can and reaching more people with our live performances. The couple also has a YouTube channel and music available to stream. Doty said they teach kindergarten through 5th grade and babies and toddlers come to their shows too. With 5th graders, especially in the upper grades, I see them letting loose, finding themselves in the joy of their movement, and correction and presenting it as they're learning. It feels right. We tend to deprive these kids so much these days, and we expect them to grow up so fast, Dodie said. Dodie said that occasionally, over the years, she received feedback from people who said they wouldn't bring the fifth graders to their assembly because it was too babyish for them. I said, they're the ones that need it much more than the kindergartners, Dodie said. The duo works as a non-profit, so they do a lot of fundraising to support their programming and offer as much as they can for free to audiences, Dodie added. There's so much work we must do in the background to plan the shows, rehearse, write, and produce the music. It feels delightful, and it's worth it, Dodie said. It's uplifting. It feels like we are ultimately doing what we are called to do, and the kids are having a great time, especially in a school context, that they're getting to move their bodies and learn about these subject matters in a fun and artistic way. Kagan added, it's what I want to do until my hair is entirely gray. For more information about Jeff and Paige, visit www.jeffandpaige.org. To see their performances, visit www.youtube.com/Jeff and Paige. Be empowered, not entitled. In a world where what can I get for free seems to be a growing mentality, I can't help but notice the pattern of entitlement and discontent it creates. There's no better place to observe this than in restaurants, where I've occasionally overheard people at nearby tables complaining about a perfectly fine meal, only to get an item comped from the bill. What's astonishing is that these diners enjoyed their food, shared laughs, and appeared to be having a wonderful time until the check arrived. Arrived. It's as if they felt a moral victory in walking away with something for nothing. But when did getting a free ride become so celebrated, and what does it say about how we approach life? I've thought about this mentality, and one analogy comes to mind. People who sit by a fireplace expecting heat without ever adding wood to the fire. They expect warmth without contributing any fuel, just like those who expect more from life without ever making deposits of their own. This notion extends beyond restaurants and fireplaces. It infiltrates many aspects of life. People complain about others who have more or live more luxuriously, begrudging them in their bigger homes, fancier cars, or exotic vacations. But instead of acknowledging the effort it took those people to achieve such success, they resent the fact that they themselves aren't living that way. It's a mindset that chooses envy over effort and dissatisfaction over discipline. This attitude isn't confined to just a few. I've seen it spill over into the workplace, especially in younger or newer salespeople who see top performers taking an afternoon off to golf or fish and wonder, why can't I do that? What they often fail to see, however, is the years of hard work, rejection, and persistence it took for those salespeople to reach a place where they could take that time off without jeopardizing their success. Those new to the field can be quick to judge, but slow to recognize the grind that their role models endured. They want the freedom, the rewards, and the lifestyle without understanding the discipline, the work ethic, and yes, even the sacrifices that made it possible. Entitlement is alluring because it offers a shortcut that promises reward without investment. But these shortcuts are often illusions that breed dependency rather than fulfillment. People who spend their energy looking for freebies or shortcuts miss out on the deep satisfaction of building something themselves. There's an empowerment that only comes when you've earned what you have. It's a confidence that isn't easily shaken, a pride that doesn't require validation. In contrast, a what-can-I-get-for-free mentality robs people of the joy and satisfaction they seek. While they may get temporary wins, a discounted meal here, a small perk there, these victories are hollow. In time, these individuals become disillusioned, wondering why they're not as happy or fulfilled as those who do the work. Become like those who stare into a fireplace, frustrated that there is no warmth, never realizing that they failed to build a fire worth stoking. As individuals, we must shift our mentality from what can I get for free to what can I contribute. There's something profoundly rewarding about putting in the wood, the work, and the sweat equity. Knowing that the warmth you'll receive isn't a gift, it's a return on your investment. We shouldn't be looking to game the system, but rather to engage in it fully, understanding that the most gratifying successes aren't free. Instead, they result from consistent effort, meaningful contributions, and a commitment to growth. In the end, life gives us what we put into it. When we start by stacking the logs, fueling the fire with our effort, we can sit back and enjoy the warmth that radiates from our labor. How do you see it? I would love to hear your story at gotonorton@gmail.com. And when we take an empowered approach to life instead of one of entitlement, it really will be a better than good life. City to offer income-based rebates on the sidewalk fee. Funding will fill gap spaces of city sidewalks. Denver's updated sidewalk ordinance was unanimously passed by the City Council in October, and the new structure includes a flat fee for many residents that will be used to fund repairs to broken and substandard sidewalks. The fund will also be used to fill in missing links in the sidewalk network. Fee collection starts for residents as soon as January and will be included on the stormwater bill residents already receive. Nearly all owners of single-family homes will pay a flat fee of $150 per year. Less than 5% of parcels, those with more than 230 linear feet of frontage, will pay an impact fee of $3.50 per linear square foot above that 230 feet threshold. Residents who are unsure of what their bills might be can look up estimates on a free website at denvergov.org/sidewalks. Denver's Department of Transportation and Infrastructure, DOTI, will offer instant rebates to homeowners who are income qualified in a program very similar to the current discounts for solid waste pickup. Homeowners who earn less than 60% of the area median income, AMI, for their household will get discounts, or what DOTI is calling an instant rebate, on the sidewalk fee, and residents who earn less than 30% of AMI for their household will not pay any sidewalk fees. Homeowners who have already applied for the income-based rebates through DOTI's solid waste program will automatically receive the sidewalk fee rebates. Income-qualified homeowners who haven't already applied for solid waste discount and who would like to receive both the rebate for solid waste pickup and the rebate for the sidewalk fee will need to apply through the city website starting in mid-December at denvergov.org/sidewalks. While renters who pay a solid waste bill with their account under their name per their landlord agreement are eligible for rebates for the solid waste program, they will not be eligible for discounts for the sidewalk fee program. The income-based rebate for the sidewalk fee program is eligible for property owners only, similar to the stormwater drainage fee. The city intends to kick off the program's master plan efforts for sidewalks in 2025 as the fees start to come in. DOTI also put out a request for qualification, RFQ, for professional services for a multidisciplinary team to provide professional support for the administration and implementation of the sidewalk program. DOTI spokesperson Nancy Kuhn indicated the city will have a multi-phased approach to repairing sidewalks next year. The first thing residents will notice is the sidewalk construction already identified and funded from the Elevate Denver and Rise Bond programs approved by voters. The second approach is a spot repair program for next year. Kuhn said that it will be focused on spot repairs that present as urgent safety hazards. We'll have a form on our website in mid to late November that people can use to report sidewalk safety issues. Our team will triage these reports. The spot repair will focus on adjoining sidewalks with gaps of more than 1 inch, elevation differences between adjoining sidewalks of greater than 1 inch, and sidewalks with extensive raveling and major breaking. Raveling is a term used to describe a sidewalk that has deteriorated and is breaking apart into little pieces. One question that has come up from residents is, what will be done with flagstone sidewalks? Currently, DOTI will not repair sections of flagstone sidewalks that are identified as safety hazards, but will replace them with concrete sidewalks. Most flagstone sidewalks cannot be reset to meet current standards for sidewalks and may pose accessibility issues for residents with disabilities. Another issue that has come up that DOTI addresses in its frequently asked questions is about residents who have recently repaired their sidewalks or have sidewalks that are in excellent condition being curious if they won't have to pay the sidewalk fee. DOTI answers it like this. We all use sidewalks in our daily lives to access schools, businesses, and parks, and to visit friends and neighbors. Having a safe and connected sidewalk network means everyone can get around with greater ease. Since everyone benefits from a complete sidewalk network, all Denver property owners are required to pay the sidewalk fee. This includes property owners whose sidewalks are currently in good repair who have recently completed new sidewalk construction on their property. Is your home fully prepared for winter? Now that our warm autumn is giving way to the cold spells of winter, have you done everything you should to prepare for cold weather? Frozen pipes should be your number one concern given the damage burst pipes can cost. Are your outdoor hose bibs the kind that resist freezing? They're easy enough to install. They work because the valve itself is deep within the unit so that it benefits from the warmth within your house. Does the caulking around your windows need refreshing? Leakage around windows is a major source of lost heat. Check your dryer vent for buildup lint, a major cause of house fires. Change the filter in your forced air furnace to improve its efficiency. I recommend annual cleaning and servicing of HVAC systems. If you have a wood-burning fireplace, when was the chimney last cleaned? Chimney fires are all too common. Tree trimming is expensive but should be considered given the increase in hurricane-force winds due to climate change. Is there a tree that could fall on your home? Consider removing it or at least trimming threatening branches. This is a good time to test your smoke and carbon monoxide detectors and maybe install fresh batteries. Clean your gutters so water doesn't collect, freeze, and back up on your roof. We have vendors to recommend for each of these tasks under the Resources tab at www.goldenrealestate.com. Department of Justice objects to key part of NAR settlement as anti-competitive. When the National Association of Realtors, NAR, agreed on March 15th to a $415 million settlement with a class of home sellers in Missouri, there were two changes which NAR agreed to make. The first was to remove from the nation's MLSs all mention of commissions being shared cooperatively with buyer brokers. The second was that all buyers must sign an agreement with any broker other than the listing agent before showing another agent's listing. Last week, the judge in that case was scheduled to affirm or deny that settlement, and on Sunday, November 30th, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a four-page statement of interest stating that, in the DOJ's opinion, the latter provision was anti-competitive and should be struck down. At press time for this column, the judge had not yet affirmed the settlement, so maybe this is old news to readers, but I wanted to share it with you in case you haven't heard about the DOJ filing. We realtors had taken a grin and bear it attitude through both rules, and I personally hadn't considered what the DOJ is now espousing. Namely, that when you ask a buyer to sign a representation agreement with one broker just to see a home, no matter how short the term of that agreement, you are limiting the ability of other brokers to compete for that buyer's business. Prior to the NAR rule, it was considered proper practice to provide a buyer with whom we interact a brokerage disclosure to buyer stating that they are a customer and not a client, but I don't know any brokers who actually did that. Thank you for joining us. It seems we are out of time for this article. You can read the full thing online. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Herald, read by Finn Chivett.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.